Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an incredibly interesting individual, Tom Johnson, the MD of Trajectory. He is a researcher, trend analyzer and forecaster, and Trajectory are an insight and foresight consultancy based in London who help clients understand how their customers, markets and the world around them is changing and how they can benefit from that change. Their proprietary international data includes Global Foresight, which draws on 100,000 consumer interviews and has been running for nearly 10 years, alongside their monthly Optimism Index monitor, which tracks consumer sentiment in the UK. So all sounds absolutely fantastic. And Tom, hi, and how are you?
I'm pretty good. Hello, Sean. Yeah, really, really good to be here. Yeah, very, very good. Looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, very much so. We were talking earlier on about that you were at the Mighty King's College and before that Exeter. So go on then. So talk us through the usual thing. Was it sort of a windy path or a sort of a very straight road that took you to where you are now with the with Trajectory?
Oh, with as with everything, entirely accident, entirely luck, nothing by design at all. So yeah, I left King's in 2009 with a master's degree in Renaissance drama, which I can assure you is absolutely no
perfect
preparation for the real world whatsoever. I kind of went and did an extra year at university because, you know, as I left Exeter, the credit crunch, as we were still calling it then, was sort of kicking off, and I thought this looks a bit hairy. I'll go back to school for a year, wait for this all to blow over. I came out a year later in desperate need of a job, and things were even worse, I think, by that point. I had a kind of vague idea of being a qualitative researcher. I knew some people a bit older than me who'd gone into that line of work. It felt like the kind of thing that maybe an English literature degree prepares you for, some research skills, some analytical skills in that kind of way. So I was kind of thinking about that, and through those inquiries heard about an internship going at this place called Trajectory, a little sort of startup, future startup. And just had absolutely no idea that such a thing could possibly exist. I mean, you're so naive, or at least I was, kind of coming out of university as to what might be out there in the real world of work. And had a chat with the chief exec and was just instantly fascinated by the kind of work that they were doing. So understanding what would now, I think, be called kind of behavioural science. Maybe it was called behavioural science back then as well, but it wasn't this sort of popular term.
Yeah, yeah.
Understanding, you know, what fundamental values and attitudes drive people's behavior, both in terms of, you know, their purchasing decisions and shopping habits, but also more broadly than that, how they relate to society, you know, long-term values, you know, what's really important to people, how technology is adopted, tolerance and you know, all those really important building blocks of society. And it's just this whole world that I didn't know sort of really could exist, and used the kind of research techniques that I was sort of vaguely aware of. Was an intern for a while and was then an analyst for a while. Have been there ever since. So it's, yeah, coming up to 14 years this year.
Wow. And I think it's really interesting in, you know, one of those things about sort of agency world and client side world, you know, there's very sort of, you know, typical conversations which go along the lines of, you know, the average sort of lifespan in work, should we say, of a marketing director is about 18 months before they move on somewhere else. And so one of the real problems has always been just the incredibly fast turnover of the client side community, when often it is actually agencies or agency personnel, as perhaps shown by yourself, that actually have far more longitude in terms of links with the brand than the clients do, which I think is a really interesting sort of tension or sort of a issue.
It is. Now, I mean, I think it's true. I mean, I'm worried people are going to realize I'm still here. I'm going to get found out. But I mean, I think that's right. And, you know, we've always prided ourselves at Trajectory on having and building long-term relationships with clients. There are a number of clients who, maybe not for the full 14 years, but certainly for a really good chunk of that, we've been working with and in different iterations. And you can kind of find a partner, whether that's for the brand or for a particular set of strategic issues. And I think then there is value in working with them. At the same time, though, you understand when people do change, there's always a value in getting new ideas and new input too. But I mean, I think the reason I've been here for so long is just, put simply, the work is fascinating. And I think being agency side gives you the opportunities to work on a diversity of projects and challenges that you wouldn't normally get a chance to work on. You know, I mentioned earlier, I spent much of today thinking about the future of funerals, which might not be everyone's cup of tea. But it's a really interesting issue. There's all sorts of practical changes in terms of that, a lot of attitudinal changes, people coming out of COVID with, you know, different experiences that were largely forced on them in terms of how they arranged or attended funerals. Yep. And just all of these sort of longer term issues about the sort of receding role of tradition and religion. And sort of instantly, you know, you can, what starts as quite a morbid or maybe quite a dry topic, you realize there's this whole world of fascinating things sitting behind it that's driving people's decision making and all sorts of big long-term consequences for the businesses involved.
Completely. And I think fascinating, people talk about, you know, there's issues around, certainly in, you know, classic stereotypical Western cultural viewpoints, perhaps towards death seem to be, so it's purely dismissed or either just, you know, not spoken about because it's too dreadful to even consider, or just dismissed as being a sort of a purely end of life thing to be thought about at the last possible moment by all concerned, as opposed to a, again, sweeping statement, classic sort of Asian perspective, which is far more part of life. You could also perhaps argue the same thing as sort of South American perspective on this. So far more to be acknowledged and dealt with in a far more naturalistic manner. But as you say, I think that fascinating point, perhaps you can talk about a bit more, is you know, we only go back a short time when along came COVID, which effectively tore up the script, as they say. So yeah, perhaps just talk a bit more about that. So go on then. So starting at death and then working our way backwards, hopefully.
So, I mean, well, the big disruption, obviously, from COVID on funerals and death would be obviously just what most people would expect to be able to do at a funeral, is invite everyone who wanted to come along to pay their respects, to have a shared moment somewhere, whether that's in a place of worship or somewhere completely different. And, you know, restrictions on who we could meet with and how many people, etc., limited that often to really just a handful of people. You know, and incredibly painful decisions were being made about that. But at the same time, it accelerated this emerging type of funeral, which is, if I'm honest, stripping out not just all of the sort of religious tradition from the funeral, but actually the quite a lot of even the sort of secular kind of more ceremonial things as well. It's this thing called direct cremation, where you just don't have any kind of service at all. It's just a very practical sort of method of you know, honor for better, but just disposing of the body. And actually, I think one of the big questions coming out of this is does that accelerate? Did people actually think, well, actually that's fine, because we can take the really interesting things about you know, what's really valuable to us, rather, about that, you know, was the shared moment that we had afterwards when we scattered the ashes, or actually wouldn't it be great if rather than a funeral we could just all get together and have, you know, a dinner in so and so's favorite restaurant, or, you know, at the beach, whatever it might be. And then I think so that there's those kinds of things as we get kind of more practical. And then I think the other really interesting thing to explore, particularly coming out of COVID, is some of the, and this actually then creeps into all sorts of other things as well, is getting into how people's priorities for their lives change as a result of COVID. And there are, I think we have a, maybe we can come back to this, but we have a tendency to overanalyze the present at times. And that happened all the time with COVID. When there's big events like that, you get a lot of kind of startism and endism. This is the end of the way we do this, the start of the way we do this. And largely, I think that's almost always not true, or at least an exaggeration. But I think one thing that did change was there was a group of people who realized that life was maybe a bit shorter than they thought it was, that there were these big things that could happen and blow their plans.
Yep.
Maybe that kind of sense of it's later than you think. And it's behind the big decrease in the proportion of people in that kind of 10 years or so before retirement age in the UK who have stopped working, because unless you have to work for financial reasons, having just been through COVID and not seeing your family as much as you want to, not being able to go away as much as you want to, not having as much time for leisure as much as you want to, why would you come out of that and say, well, you know what, I'm going to carry on doing, I'm going to carry on working full time? So I think there's all of those changes in people's values and what they want out of life and how they think about the future that comes out of a moment like COVID or a period like COVID, mm-hmm. that I think is really interesting and obviously speaks to end of life planning, but it speaks to other things as well too.
Yeah, totally. I remember a while ago I interviewed Thierry Malory, who wrote The Great Reset with Klaus Schwab for the World Economic Forum. And one of the points they talked about in the Great Reset was in terms of that exact quote about, they started off with, COVID tore up the script in terms of how to govern countries and indeed companies, how to live with others and take part in the global economy. And the one thing that we didn't want to do at that point was, as they put it, we didn't want to return to the broken sense of normality that prevailed prior to the crisis. Really interesting stuff. So just in terms of, again, going back perhaps slightly with regards to what it is that you do, again, so for those who are unaware of literally that the sort of the scope of services that agencies like yourselves, put out there, go on then, perhaps just talk a bit about that. So, client walks to the door and says, right, what have you got? Then, as you lay out the service sort of roster, as it were, what's on the table?
It's a really good prompt, actually, Sean. Quite often you get into the really interesting discussion before actually establishing what it is that you might be able to help with. You summed it up really well at the beginning. We help organizations understand how the world is changing and what that change means for them. And actually the range of things that we do in response to that can vary really widely. It depends on what the kind of client's question is. Sometimes it's a really short-term question about what does the next year look like? How do I launch this product? What should this new product look like? Yep. Sometimes it's something much more kind of customer audience focused. I want to understand how this group of people have changed, what's important to them now that maybe wasn't there in the past, or is there a group of people that we need to be aware of that we're not. A lot of the time it's much longer term than that. So we help a lot of organizations and from, public sector, private sector charities help think about the future in a much more strategic way. So if they're working on, as all organizations should, thinking about what the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years means for them, they might have a strategy that helps guide them through that. And that strategy should be informed, what we always think, by robust futures thinking as well, which is where we might start deploying scenario planning or horizon scanning techniques, those kinds of thing. Occasionally there's a role for econometric modeling and more statistical forecasts in there as well. And we can do all of the above. But yeah, fundamentally, it's about using a variety of insight and foresight techniques to help any organization understand what the future means for them.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of that, by the way, again, there seems to have been, a lot of debate, if you say, certainly in the sort of in brand world, in the marketing community, about this issue around, in terms of time, the tension between the short-termism, you've got to hit the numbers angle versus perhaps the luxury of long-term forecasting, or perhaps the absolute vital need for long-term forecasting. So I just wonder how things sort of playing out with yourselves at the moment in terms of, if one could have a sort of ratio of, the briefs coming over the desk, is everyone, obsessed with the short-term and or 90% of them and only 10% long-term, or is it other way around or something else? Or
I think probably a bit more the long term, actually. I think it's one of the other things that COVID has done is, I think, it, it, you, you used the quote earlier, tearing up the script. I think that happened for a lot of organizations. It forced them to reset their assumptions about the future. They would have gone into the beginning of 2020 with one set of expectations, well-informed or not, about what the next decade or the next few years might bring. And within a few months of that would have been completely out of the window, because we were living through this, you know, epochal event. So I think in a lot of organizations, you know, whether they were, you know, just launching a new strategy or thinking about the future in a more kind of proactive way, would have been forced to think about the longer term, maybe in a way that they wouldn't have had to before, to recognize that the future is uncertain, but that by asking the right questions, you can at least embrace a bit of that uncertainty. So I think a bit more of the longer term. But I think the other issue, I think that where you do get to the tension, is there can be a focus on just weathering the storm at the same time, and it can change sort of sector by sector. This, but you know, during COVID, there was one set of organisations, particularly in, I guess, kind of retail, leisure, hospitality, who, because the nature of their operations was so focused on what they could do at different points during the pandemic, you know, were they allowed to open, how many people were allowed to be in the indoors or not, could they get a license to serve out on the street, all of that kind of stuff, they really were, you know, operations just became a huge focus for them. You know, how do we manage this, you know, on a kind of month-to-month basis, rather than asking sort of longer term strategic questions, which is completely understandable. I think there's a sort of similar thing going on right now with the kind of pressures around the sort of pandemic hangover of the cost of living crisis and supply chain issues and things like that. That there's a danger that you could get a bit too bogged down in the present without thinking about, well, actually we're now sufficient distance from the pandemic and sufficient way into this particular set of pressures around cost of living and the economy waking up from COVID, you can start to, I think, map out with a little more certainty what the rest of the decade starts to look like. And so I completely understand the focus on the shorter term, and, you know, from an operational point of view. And often, you know, the chief exec of a business will be thinking about what that quarter's results means for shareholders, for their position. But the longer term is essentially, you've got to try and maintain a handle on both, I think.
Mm. And then meanwhile, someone sort of rolls a grenade in the room with ChatGPT on it, and everyone loses their minds, as it were. So
yeah, we like a shiny new toy, don't we? There was a great bit of work we did at the end of 2019, and it was looking back at predictions that had been made in 2009 about what the world would look like in 2020. And there was, I mean, it was really, really interesting. There's obviously lots of stuff, you know, that different organizations were doing back then that was really good and very well thought through. Not a lot of it was all that accurate, such as the nature of long-term forecasts. But one of the things that we consistently found was that forecasts from 2009 about what the world would look like in 2020 consistently overestimated the impact of technology. You know, they were talking about driverless cars and brain user interfaces and, you know, widespread automation at a scale that we just still haven't seen and probably won't see for a while.
Yeah.
And consistently underestimated the impact of much slower moving and frankly more boring trends in things like demographics. I think that's a perpetual challenge for this kind of work, is that, you know, quite often you are drawn to the shiny things that could be fundamentally transformative, and you take your eye off the stuff that's either moving more slowly or which just doesn't really change at all. It's sort of, I think it's kind of overly simplistic potentially, but I'll say it anyway. You tell me if it's overly simplistic. I find it quite useful to think about the future as being comprised of two things: things that are different and things that are the same. And the things that attract attention are the things that are going to be different. But they're, in almost any futures timeline, a relatively small part of the overall picture. Just as important are the things which don't really change at all.
I think Mr. Bezos would totally agree with you there, and he's done quite well. So
quite.
And in terms of some of the reports that you saw him putting out, I was looking again at the site earlier on. So go on then. So things like a great title. So How Not to Be a Political Brand. Go on then.
So this is a fascinating. I mean, this is something that's evolved for a while. It's a trend that we monitor very closely, and it really came out of that incredibly sort of volatile period around 2016, 2017, when people shouldn't have been shocked by the result of the EU referendum and shouldn't have been shocked by Donald Trump winning the presidency, but mm-hmm. but were.
Yeah,
and I think it rocked a lot of people, and it caused brands eventually to realize that this sort of political, this sort of center ground of politics and communications that they'd lived in just wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
It was really encapsulated. There was a tweet by Paper Chase, which we used to show in presentations, and they were issuing a groveling apology. Like, it's the most unbelievably groveling apology for this horrible crime that they'd committed. And you sort of, without context, you'd have assumed that they were involved in some sort of international drug trafficking scandal or something like that. Just absolutely awful. And the apology they were issuing was for giving away free wrapping paper in the Daily Mail. And people have strong views about the Daily Mail. You know, I'm not a fan of it or its politics, but that's just completely normal mainstream activity. You know, it's before that period, 2016, 2017, just wouldn't have been a controversial thing at all. And I think the Sun had to apologize for a similar, Pizza Hut had to apologize for doing a similar thing in the Sun, or felt it had to apologize. And we noticed increasingly after that, and there were some sort of forward-thinking brands who did this quite well, Nike being a great example, who realized that there was a role for them in deliberately playing in to these sort of culture war kind of debates by taking a stand, by being provocative. And Nike did this probably the most successfully with the Colin Kaepernick advert, I think, which came out in 2017 or 2018.
Yeah.
Which was just walking head first into the sort of bullets of that particular debate. Just really, sure. It's such a huge, it probably didn't quite have the same impact in the UK, but obviously in the US, a hugely divisive issue. And Nike really able to have its cake and eat it, kind of betting that it would attract enough support and develop a strong enough bond with its sort of urbanite metropolitan customers who would have been on the side of Colin Kaepernick on that side of that debate.
Yeah.
Without really thinking that people who disagreed with them would be demotivated to buy, Nike trainers next time they saw them. I know there were some people who started burning their Nike gear and posting it on Twitter. But, Nike continued to donate to both Republican and Democrat causes after that. It was a sort of sense of having its cake and eating it. And there were, I think, all sorts of examples of brands realizing that there was an opportunity for them to achieve just a much greater level of cut through by being a bit more provocative, by taking a stand, by being a political brand. And, you saw some didn't do it so successfully, but you kind of understand the rationale why. So, Gillette had a campaign updating its sort of the best a man can get to best a man can be, sort of taking on toxic masculinity stereotypes. I don't think it was so successful, but they had to do something because Gen Z to millennials just didn't see themselves in that Gillette brand, that kind of hero brand, millionaire sportsmen, men getting paid even more millions to advertise this sort of, razor when actually, there's other brands, Dollar Shave Club and a million others who are talking to them in a much, a much more resonant level. HSBC did a similar thing with the Brexit debate in the UK, the kind of We Are Not an Island campaign, which we sort of spoke to that as well. And it's just really, I think an interesting way that brands realize that they have quite a strong voice to play. And it's evolved over the years. And actually, I think what you see now, it was sort of stopped in its tracks a little bit by COVID, because COVID, suddenly we were all in the same boat. And the fragmentation and the polarization that had been so characteristic of our times before then, suddenly that went out the window. We discovered neighborliness and community, and we were a lot nicer about one another back then. And that's probably waning a little bit. But certainly that sense of social collectivism was pretty strong during that period. And it kind of took some of the heat out of that. And again, you know, don't know why I'm always surprised, but always impressed by the speed with which brands can respond to that kind of change. And you saw by the end of the year, you know, brands sort of reflecting that quite collectivist stance. You know, there was that example of Burger King donating its social space to independents and getting a lot of kudos, you know, as a result of that.
Yeah.
But I wonder if a bit of this is going to start to come back. You know, we're into an era where I'm not sure there's sort of a lot in that center ground still, you know, we still feel quite polarized politically. A lot of the big issues that people are talking about are highly political issues. And so I wonder if there's a bit more space for it. I think the thing that doesn't, that is really hard, particularly in a UK context, I think it's all rumble on and on and on in the US. But in a UK context is Brexit is seen by the majority of people as being done, whether they voted for it or not, whether they identify with the Leave tribe or the Remain tribe or not, that's done. So that takes a lot of the heat out of it. But really interesting that brands just realized that actually they should be a bit more political. And it kind of rumbles on and has a life from the United States, because if you look at things like abortion control and things like that in the United States, it creates some very uncomfortable situations for international brands based in red states in the US, which are trying to enact incredibly restrictive abortion controls. You know, if you're making a product in, you know, Tennessee or Georgia, as Netflix do a lot of their filming in Georgia in the US, do they want to carry on doing that if they are associated with a state that has some of the most restrictive abortion legislation in the Western world? They probably don't. And actually, Netflix started raising funds to fight a proposed ban in the courts. So I think there's all sorts of really interesting examples of our more complex, polarized political world. Brands having to find a way to deal with that. All comes out of that political brand strength, which is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually discussing that exact point with the sort of head of ethics from one of the big American universities in a sort of a podcast to come fairly soon. But in terms of that other points around the macro lie of the land and the sort of the public zeitgeist, as you're saying, loads of sort of talk about inequality, huge amount of resentment out there, and a lot of spinning of that at every point of the sort of political spectrum. But meanwhile, one of the things that you put out, which I think is really, really interesting, is the optimism index. So what is it? Yeah. So 1,500 adults a month in the UK talking about confidence, personal choice and control, social trust, opportunities in tech, optimism, and their place in the world. What a great selection of things to talk about. So go on then, any of those, off you go.
Yeah, well, this is our, I mean, as far as we see it, this is our kind of permission to talk about, the way consumers and people are thinking and how their lives are changing. We got a bit frustrated with sort of traditional sort of public or consumer sentiment barometers being obsessed with finances, and also being quite backwards looking. So they would tell us a couple of months later how people felt about their finances, a few months ago. And we're a bit frustrated with it. You know, it's not the only lens through which to understand people's behavior and their attitudes and their outlook. And we also felt there was a real need for something that was a bit more forward looking. And we do, it's a challenge, but we do try and be optimistic about the future. So we felt that a barometer that was measuring public levels of optimism about the future would be a really useful way of understanding how consumers were changing. And there's obviously, you don't get too far away from the economics and the finances of it, because clearly that's really important. So since 2018, every month we've been measuring optimism. There have been some highs and lows in consumer sentiment, it's fair to say, since then. I mean, really interestingly, you know, kind of going back to the pandemic, we would have bet that it absolutely plummeted during the first lockdown, but it kind of held up, actually. And it only kind of really started to fall towards the end of that year, when people got a sense of, kind of going back into this again, no vaccine in sight just yet, you know, how long is, you know, real sort of loss of control people felt, you know, you speak about autonomy and control. That was when people felt really helpless at the end of 2020. You know, there was a sort of whispers of support being withdrawn and the chaos around the tiers. People just didn't really know what the future would hold. It only really picked up again when we had a kind of roadmap for reopening in 2021.
Yep.
Kind of unsurprisingly, over the last year or so, we've seen the optimism index break new ground, all very miserable ground. We've had a series of, we keep trying to find, I mean, it's called the optimism index. And at times last year, we were holding serious conversations about rebranding it the pessimism index, because it just was, it was gloomy to write. It was gloomy to read. It's just very negative scores month on month. Every month, the score seemed to be lower than the one than the one before. But we do think, and actually we hosted an event last month which was called The Return of Optimism, because we do think that one of our central expectations for this year is that, at least in a kind of consumer sense, optimism is going to rebound, because it's a forward-facing indicator. Often people respond to it not based on how their lives are necessarily going right now, but how they expect them to be in the future. So as soon as you see kind of green shoots of recovery, your optimism should improve, and that then affects your you know, in a commercial sense, your spending decisions. It affects your openness to information. You know, one of the yep. things that we have consistently found in the course of doing this is that optimistic consumers not only do more and spend more, but actually are more open to information. They're more willing to try new things. They've got a more positive perspective on new technology. There's all of these really quite fundamental things about people's outlook and how they relate to the wider world that are really based on how optimistic we feel. You know, even the extent to which we're sort of introverts or extroverts, I think that exists on a bit of a spectrum, and we move into the more extroverted bit of it when we're feeling more positive about the future. And one of the things we saw during the pandemic was optimism just rapidly recover in what for me was, I think, the worst period of it, which was sort of January 2021, you know, another lockdown, a lockdown in winter, a sense of here we go again. But from that point, optimism just surged because there was a plan. People could see that there was this roadmap for reopening. People could yep. see vaccines were being rolled out. You know, they were going into people's arms. There was just hope for the future. And people reacted not to things being better, but to the prospect of things being better in the future. And I think there is the chance that we start to get better economic news throughout the year. You know, inflation should start falling pretty rapidly in the spring and the summer. There's, you know, this is only relative good news, but a recession that's likely to be a bit shorter than first expected. It's possible that we start to see some good news on that towards the end of the year. And there will be people who are able to sort of throw off the shackles a little bit, and that's going to drive optimism upwards.
Yes.
And the other thing that I think is really important in this context is just that, again, going to the non-financial drivers of sentiment, is the things that people really enjoy and that people are really important to them are starting to come back after a kind of break for COVID.
Yep.
So, you know, marriages, you know, people going to weddings, foreign holidays. The number of people who've experienced positive life events like that. There's even, I think, a bit of a kind of post-pandemic baby boom happening. So more people having, you know, children and grandchildren in the family, which is obviously a joyous thing.
Yeah,
he says with his wife heavily pregnant in the other room.
Not very good.
There's all of these things kind of coming back too, which is just is just a boost to people.
Yeah. By the way, in terms of the tourism thing, in the Economist viewpoint, in terms of the world to come, one of the key issues they focused on was, they termed the wonderful title, revenge tourism. Okay, then, and in terms of some of the other things that you talk about in there, from the point of view of things like sort of social trust.
Yeah, social trust is deeply, deeply negative, and remains so. And actually, one of the really interesting things about it is we measure trust based on how much people trust other people, which is generally reasonably high, at least compared to some other measures, and then trust in sources of information, to the media, trust in businesses, and trust in politicians. And one of the things that's really interesting is not, I guess, it shouldn't be surprising that trust in politicians is particularly low. It did manage to plumb new depths last year, possibly unsurprisingly in the UK. But actually, it started to have an outsized impact on overall sentiment in a way that it didn't used to. It didn't used to be one of the biggest things that drove people's overall optimism, because it's kind of priced in. You know, we don't really trust politicians. We don't really believe what they say. You know, we take what they say with a pinch of salt. Maybe we pay a bit more attention in a run up to an election. But generally we kind of tune them out because we don't trust them. And then last year it started being, alongside consumer confidence, which, bear in mind, is in the middle of a cost of living crisis that people haven't really experienced for decades, one of the biggest drivers of overall optimism. You know, that, you know, we were seeing optimism plunge, and a big part of it was a lack of trust. Yep. And it's hugely challenging. It's obviously not just the fault of Boris Johnson, as much as it might be easy to lay the blame for things at one person's door. Obviously, high profile scandals that are about integrity contribute to that. It's also about, you know, the fragmentation of our information ecosystem and the ability to prove anything with facts, and, you know, all of this kind of thing. Yeah, that's a big worry, I think. You know, there's a trend we talk about called the democratization of information, which just broadly describes how we, you know, we have access to an extraordinary amount of information, you know, in a way that, you know, the kind of cost of accessing it, to it, the barriers to accessing the world's knowledge have fallen, obviously, so dramatically over the past few decades. And there are good elements to that, and there are really, really, really negative elements to that as well. And I think occasionally we see the more negative elements of that sort of rear their heads.
Okay, and then just to finish off that particular strand, because it's such a fascinating sort of element and sort of actually foundation, very much of what, as I understand, trajectory all about. So you also talk about, as I understand it, people's sort of place in the world. Which I think is really interesting to talk about that. So go on. So when you're asking people about that precise point, what's the sentiment there? What's coming back?
It's strongly different by generation. So what, there's a couple of things. We ask about national pride and the importance of national identity. And we ask about whether or not people feel they are a citizen of the world. And I mean, that was a very useful question for understanding both before and after the EU referendum, you know, how you might have different attitudes, different tribes of people. Do people feel strongly British or whatever nationality they are, or do people feel much more global in their outlook, in their identity? And you saw, perhaps predictably, very strong differences depending on your generation. Generally, obviously, it doesn't include everyone, and generational analysis is flawed in this kind of way. But older people were less likely to agree that they were citizens of the world. Younger people were more likely to agree that they were citizens of the world. What was particularly interesting, though, was looking at the youngest people. So Gen Z, only the oldest Gen Z are in our sample. It's only 18 plus. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of Gen Z are still teenagers, obviously. Yeah. But we were seeing, with this sort of emerging Gen Z sample, they were able to sort of, they were quite paradoxical. They were both strongly agreed that they were citizens of the world and kind of had that kind of quite globalist outlook, but also were much more, felt their national identity was much more important to them as well. They were a real break with the millennial generation, who were kind of one or the other. And, you know, older generations were one or the other as well, but just the other way. But Gen Z are managing to kind of balance these apparently conflicting aspects of their identity together in what I think must be, just be quite a healthy way. You know, be able to be, to, you know, yes, I'm British, but also I'm European too. And yeah. Maybe there's a level of nuance there that was probably lost in some elements of the Brexit debate.
Yeah. And in terms of nuances, one of the other reports that I saw you put out recently, or certainly one of the headings of it, I thought was very intriguing, was, myths of decline are often wrong. Go on then.
They are almost always. I mean, this speaks, I think, hopefully to your ethos, but certainly to ours at Trajectory as well. The future gets a bad press, and the present gets a bad press as well. And we are, I think, suckered into thinking that today is worse than yesterday, that there was this golden age, this sort of sepia-toned golden age of, you know, where life was better. And it was always 50 years ago. whether you're making an argument 30 years ago, whether you're making it today, it was always 50 years ago. And it's always wrong. Whatever the challenges are for today, people live longer. People spend more of their life in good health. I think they're two pretty fundamental things that suggest that life is better today, if there's more of it. People, despite financial pressures today, are wealthier than they were most periods in the past. There's all sorts of, even some of the more, kind of prosaic things, entertainment's better than it was. We have more choice about what to watch on TV. That's better than it was.
Yeah.
All of these things, there are major scientific breakthroughs every day. Just in the last year, there have been huge breakthroughs in terms of gene editing and, base editing, gene therapy and nuclear fusion technology. Even you mentioned earlier about ChatGPT, which I know makes some people terrified, but deployed properly should bolster productivity and give us more free time and just simplify tasks. So there's all sorts of, I think, reasons to be optimistic, and there are just pervasive myths of decline. And there's an archivist, a Canadian archivist called Paul Ferry, who about once a week, once a month, posts just the most brilliant Twitter thread, just cataloguing from usually journals, local newspapers, going back over 100, 120 years, the sort of boring myth of decline sentiments. And every 10 years you go back, the same sentiment being uttered. There was one that we pulled out and talked about recently. People just don't want to work anymore. And it's always, this is another thing that actually never changes. Generations really hate the generations that follow them. I think purely through jealousy. Youth is wasted on the young.
Yeah.
But this sort of idea that nobody wants to work anymore, and you kind of the starting point was a survey in 2022. X% of business leaders say, we're having trouble recruiting because nobody wants to work anymore. Then an example of the same sentiment from 2008 going back and back and back and back to the 1890s and people complaining that, the kids today didn't want to work anymore. And actually, for as far back as you can get data, which isn't quite as far back as the 1890s, employment has largely increased throughout that time. So there's just no real evidence behind this sort of myths of decline at all. But they're so tempting. They're always worth disproving, because the future is better than today. It's one of the impacts of our big decline optimism over the past year, actually, which is it's not just short term optimism that is threatened at the moment. And it's sort of understandable that short term optimism is threatened because life has been very difficult for people over the past year. But longer term as well, there's a couple of questions that we ask. Asking a version of that kind of golden age question, is life today better or worse than it was 50 years ago? And then a question that we ask, do you think life will be better in 20 years' time or worse? And generally people fall into one of two groups. Either people think that life is worse today and is going to carry on getting worse, or people think that life is better today and is going to carry on getting better. And in normal, quote unquote, normal times, when there's not a big cost of living crisis or a big pandemic going on, slightly more people are in the better and better camp, which is just about reassuring to me. But over the past year, that camp has shrunk. It's now barely a third of people. The last time we looked at this at the end of 2022, and the group of people in that kind of worse and worse camp is around half of the population. And that I think is the big worry, because there are all sorts of kind of grand challenges that we face in the future. How to make the most of new technology. So ChatGPT and all sorts of generative AI programs, they could have real negative implications for society, or they could have really positive ones. Similarly, there are ways to deal with the challenges of an aging society. There are ways to grow and be green at the same time. Net zero and sustainability is a huge challenge, but you're not going to realize those if you think, what's the point? We're all doomed anyway. And so I think that's the kind of what's at stake with regard to optimism, and why it's so important to measure and why it's so important to monitor.
Yeah, totally. And I thought about just going back slightly, your point about every generation complaining about the youth of the day. I think that goes right back to sort of Pliny, doesn't it? And Pliny complaining about sort of a drunken Roman youth sort of staggering around the Colosseum, vomiting behind the sort of charioteer, or whatever. But meanwhile,
there's often a moral dimension to it as well. Yeah, that's definitely true.
And then just pushing on, I'm aware of time. It's been so interesting talking with you. Go on then. It's a slightly sort of separate issue, but books and all the rest of it. Anything out there that you are a current sort of a champion of? Anything you're reading, watching that you would recommend?
There is indeed. In fact, there's a brilliant book which has just come out called The Human Experience by John Sills, which is absolutely fantastic. It's I think we have a fair bit in common, not just that we're both Arsenal fans, but that in terms of sort of the outlook that John has in terms of the way companies need to talk to their customers and need to understand their customers in order to be resilient, in order to think strategically about the future. So it's a fantastic, very wise, very funny book, just sharing strategies how organizations can become more customer centric. And there's one thing in particular which I think is just so hugely important, which is in so many cases you look at companies, and the people who make decisions are the furthest from the end customer, almost always. And it's just how so many organizations set themselves up. And sometimes it's, you know, an unconscious thing. Sometimes it's a conscious thing. Sometimes it's an unconscious thing. But if you want to weather storms like, you know, the ones we've experienced, understanding your customers and keeping them close and taking care of them is obviously absolutely key. And there's a lot of wisdom in the book, the Human Experience, which would help any organization understand how to do that.
Fantastic. So go on then, as we begin to finish off. So key takeaway points, if you were doing your elevator pitch with your ideal potential client, go on then. How are you setting yourselves up as sort of a points of difference and all the rest of it?
It's a really good question. I'm terrible at elevator pitches, as you might have been able, gleaned. Tendency. It has to be quite a long elevator. Are we in the shot?
Good point. Yeah.
We're going up quite a long way. I think there's a couple of things right now. I mean, one is not to overanalyze the present. You know, we tend to get bogged down in what's right in front of us and to assume that the moment we're living through is a defining one and take our eye off the slower moving trends. At the same time, there is a need to balance both short-term change and longer-term change to understand what's really going to happen and what's really going to be important for any organization. So hopefully that's a sort of short enough to be an elevator pitch, although I suspect
very good.
I suspect the person in the elevator has already got off by that point.
Right, as we sort of hurtle upwards at the sort of Burj Khalifa. And then, Gonet, so in terms of next big thing, if you can talk about it, that's coming along for Trajectory, anything sort of coming down the line that you're launching or talking about or any events coming up, etc.?
There's some fascinating projects coming, which I can't talk about just yet. But hopefully, when things are published, we'll be able to share those. The next big thing we're talking about at Trajectory, we run a series of webinars which are free to attend, so trends briefings at the end of every month, and we're looking the next one at the end of February on sustainability. And particularly the outlook for sustainability during a crisis. It's that balance of short-term and long-term. It's a big, looming, long-term challenge that's on the horizon. But short-term, actually, can we raise our heads above the kind of parapet of cost of living crisis and post-pandemic hangover, both a consumer perspective on that, a policy-making perspective on that, and an organisational perspective on that too.
Very nice. And in terms of where people can link into that, so go on then, where are you on all these your platforms and all the rest of it, both you individually and also the agency?
So you can follow me on Twitter, although I'm very rarely on Twitter these days. It's not an Elon Musk protest, but it sort of coincide with that. Mostly on LinkedIn. So yeah, do check out either me on LinkedIn or the trajectory page on LinkedIn. There's loads of updates. We share more stuff than we should from our proprietary data on there. So there's always interesting stuff there. And also, if you go onto our website, you can sign up to our newsletter, which again contains loads of case studies, analysis, data, reports, all of that kind of stuff.
Nice. Well, as I say, sharing is always good. So excellent stuff. Well, in that case, all it needs for me to say is to Tom Johnson, MD of Trajectory, researcher, trend analyzer, and forecaster. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much, Sean. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. Just so you know, the trends and insights discussed in these podcasts link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info, and to ongoing cultural and social research conducted by brandpositive.org. Till next time, goodbye.